Sairam, dear listeners, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I welcome you to this week's episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. The very outset, heartfelt greetings on the occasion of Navratri. Navratri is one of the most important festivals in the Indian calendar and one of the festivals that is being celebrated in Swami's presence by devotees since the 1940s. I think I would not be wrong in making this observation that even before Swami's birthday celebrations become a regular feature of the Prashanti calendar, the Navratri or Dashara celebrations were. The very fact that Swami gave it importance is an indication to us that these 9 days are very significant and, more importantly, conducive for one's spiritual progress. So a happy, holy and spiritual Devi Navratri to each one of you. We call this festival the Devi Navratri because during this festival, we worship the various forms of Mother Goddess, Devi. But it is not worshipping the Mother Goddess really, it is worshipping God as the Mother Principle. And whenever it is Devi Navratri, I cannot but remember a very profound incident and, more importantly, a profound statement that Swami made. I'm sure many of you still receive the Sanatan Sarathi, the magazine which is published in the ashram. If you do, you will know that every issue comes with one very beautiful full-page picture of Swami. Apparently for many, many years, Swami would himself review the picture and see if it is suitable for the magazine. Well, this happened when one of the Dashara issues were being prepared. It was the month of the Navratri festival. So they had printed a picture of Mother Durga on one side and one of Swami on the other. Under the picture of Goddess Durga, they had printed these words, Durga Mata. And under Swami's picture, they had printed the words, Satya Sai Mata. Swami looked at both the pictures and then read what was written below. Then pointing to the words under his picture, Swami said, "Change this." Swami continued, "Don't put Satya Sai Mata, put Satya Mata. Because this alone is Satya Mata, every other Mata is only Mithya Mata." Swami explained that he alone is Satya Mata, the true mother. All other mothers are physical mothers, are Mithya Mata, illusory. Swami alone is the true mother. On this most auspicious occasion of the first day of Devi Navratri, let us offer our most loving pranams at the lotus feet of this Satya Mata. Let's then head straight to the program, dear listeners, and to start with, it's the quote for the day. The quote I'm going to read out is not from a person who is very famous. You may not know the person if I name her too. It's from a blog written by one Miss Veronica Grania Sierra. So let me first read it out, and this is the quote. I quote, "We have all experienced those voices in our head, those emotions and feelings that cover us in a shadow of darkness and manifest into our lives. They are known as our inner demons. It's a battle that goes on inside all of us, whether it be our fears, sadness, anxiety, frustrations, and disappointments tormenting us and preventing us from experiencing happiness, peace, love, and hope. Just like with every battle, there are two options. You can choose to hide from these demons and negative energies, or you can choose to fight these demons and confront and conquer them." End of quote. We started with speaking about Navratri. In fact, this is also a festival that symbolizes the epic battle between the good and evil. It does not just signify the victory of good over evil, but even the struggle itself. Because we all wish the victory, but many of us are not prepared for the fight. And when we talk about fighting the internal evil forces, it's a day and night battle, not like facing a difficult colleague, neighbor, or for that matter, even a spouse. but our own negative emotions. As she says in those lines, the emotions of fears, sadness, anxiety, frustrations and disappointments. These are as much within us as the emotions of happiness, peace and confidence are. And this battle is one that we cannot avoid or take a break from. And we must choose to fight against these evil tendencies and establish the noble ones. Well, Swami would make this point on every Navratri that this festival must remind us of the battle that we are supposed to wage inside each one of us. And this battle is not like a conflict or war outside between two other entities. If it is such, I can choose to be a witness, turn away, leave the conflict zone, or take sides and participate. But when it comes to this battle within, I have only two choices. I can hide, which is essentially postponing the conflict, or face the devil now and fight. Even in a war, the best strategy is to confront the enemy when you have a strong ally. In this inner conflict, we all are so fortunate to have found the best ally we could ever ask for and ever find, and that is Swami. So there is no better time to fight than now. Let us take on this battle with Swami by our side, then victory is guaranteed. So dear listeners, before we head to the question for this week, let me read that quote one more time. I quote, "We have all experienced those voices in our head, those emotions and feelings that cover us in a shadow of darkness and manifest into our lives. They are known as our inner demons. It's a battle that goes on inside all of us, whether it be our fears, sadness, anxiety, frustrations and disappointments tormenting us and preventing us from experiencing happiness, peace, love and hope. Just like with every battle, there are two options. You can choose to hide from these demons and negative energies, or you can choose to fight these demons and confront and conquer them. Alright then, let's head to the question for this week. The question we're going to be handling today is from Ms. Kavita Rajesh. And the question is going to be read out by one of our volunteers. Sister Sumana is going to read it out for us. So let's listen to this question. I'm sure it's an important one, especially if you're parenting a child. And this is a question that you wouldn't want to miss. So let's listen to the question in the voice of Sister Sumana and then we'll answer it.
Sai Ram, in one of the talks in Radio Sai, I had heard about this incident where a student said in Swami's presence that talent is God's gift. But then Swami told him in return that talent is God. With this background, as parents, if we recognize a talent in our child, should we hone it despite the seeming resistance of a child who might not be able to understand the value of that gift? To what extent is it the parent's responsibility? And what should be done if the child is reluctant, maybe due to peer pressure or some other influencer? For example, if a child is artistic, but suddenly decides to stop doing due to the sole reason that his friends do not consider it cool. What is the point where the parents have to stop being pushy and let go? Sai Ram.
Thank you, Sister Kavita, for that question. A very important one, especially as parents when we are trying to bring up our children. We, of course, give them the regular education, but when there is a spark of a talent, when the child is good at doing something, and most often we know that there is always resistance to any form of disciplined upbringing of the child, be it, you know, academically or even these extracurricular activities. So it's an important question of how much should a parent really push, which is the point where one actually backs off and says that I've done my bit. There are other interesting aspects to that question too. I think that will give us the scope to speak a little more in general about the idea of talent itself. But before that, I'll break that question into three different segments I'll be talking about. One is, of course, how much can parents push their children in honing talents? And a few specific questions in relation to that that you've asked, especially about peer pressure and how you deal with that. The second aspect is a few mistakes that parents tend to do. You know, probably we'll speak about that a little so that you can, for yourself, ensure that, ask yourself and ensure that you're not doing those mistakes. I think that's an important way of looking at it too. And finally, the more general explanation of what Swami exactly means when he says that talent is God, and how that is very, very relevant, be it for this situation of a parent explaining and helping the child develop a talent, or even for each one of us, the way we look at talent, any talent for that matter. To the first part, you know, how much can parents push their children in honing talents? A general principle, which I think I mentioned before when some other question on parenting was here, generally Swami says that parents should be in the driver's seat or in complete control and decisions of the child at least till the age of 15 or 16. I think that's something which is changing now. Most of us, even at the age, even when the child is about 12 years, 13 years, and just going into adolescence, we, you know, constantly ask them, what do you want? What is it that you like? There's nothing wrong in that. But Swami says that, I mean, that's not the age when the mind is completely developed and matured enough to make some important decisions which are going to actually define the rest of your life. So Swami says that at least till the age of 15 or 16, the parents can take every important decision in the child's life. So how long can you do that? I think this is what Swami says, till the age of 15 or 16. I mean, of course, Swami would say that even after that, a child is supposed to be always obedient to the parents, but given the situation today, at least till the age of 15 or 16, which means at least till the school-going years, I think the parents have every right to make the decisions for their child. And as much as possible, it has to be like that. I think many parents, in the desire to be popular amongst the children, become very friendly from a very young age, which is very nice. But as I had also mentioned in a previous answer, that this relationship between a parent and a child should always be governed by reverence. The friendliness can be there. There is friendliness in every other relationship, but this particular relationship has a lot to gain by the reverence aspect that exists between the mother and the child, or the father and the child. So that has to be maintained. That's very, very important. So just like how you decide matters relating to the school. I mean, I'm sure as children we all had resistance even to the idea of going to school. We did not like sitting and doing our homework. We did not like sitting in a classroom for a good part of our day and a good part of our childhood. But we were forced to do that because that was the right thing for us, and that's what has brought us where we are. So just like how you make those choices for your child when it comes to honing a specific talent in your child, if you find that the child is good at music or it's good at sport and you want the child to develop through the process of a regularized training, I think consider that also as part of probably your schooling. And just like how you wouldn't take the child's opinion about whether or not to go to school, I think you should not take the child's opinion when it comes to even these things. If you feel that there is a talent and it has to be honed, there's nothing wrong in the parents putting the child in any form of regularized training so that that talent can develop, right? And if it is about because of peer pressure, which actually happens a lot of times, especially when you're trying to teach your children something more classical, something more traditional, there's always this resistance. And I've come across many of these parents who would want to teach their child a tabla or a mridangam, where the child will be interested in drums because that's the more hip thing, that's the more popular talent in the school. But I think, as I said, the choice should be with the parents. You are in a better position to decide for the child than the child himself. So when it comes to peer pressure, one of the things that you can do and you must do is ensure that the child has that kind of company which is conducive for the child's growth. When you feel that this is how the child will do well, then you should also ensure that the child is in the company of people who think likewise. I know it's not very easy all the time, but as much as possible, wherever you can. But more importantly, I think it's it is a development in the child that you have to look at much more than just in this aspect. That is, you'll have to explain to the child what is this idea of being popular among peers, because that is something which influences much of their life. It's not just about talents, it's about what they do, it's about how they dress, it's about how they behave at home and how they behave in public places. All of this is defined by this, you know, the pressure which comes because of what the others think, those friends, the peer group, what they think about the child. So it's very important to, in general, explain to the children that, you know, it's being cool is not about doing what others define as cool. Because that is something, if you start doing at a young age, probably you'll do that for the rest of your life. You will, your life and the patterns of your life will be defined by people around you and what they approve of and what they disapprove of. So it's important to, in a very general manner, talk to the child about getting out of this, you know, this net of wanting to do everything that others think is cool and others think is the right way of doing things. And put this idea that what is really cool is what you choose to do, you are able to stick to that and you're able to do it in spite of whatever others around you think of. I think that's the more cool thing, right? That's what defines what we call success. So that is a general idea that that'll have to be inculcated into the children. That those people who now look at you and say, oh, you're going for these classes, oh, you're trying to learn this art, and that's so old-fashioned. At a point when the child excels, you should explain to the child that, you know, these people who are making all these comments will again come back and admire the child for those same talents. So this is a very general thing. This is not just specific to this point of, honing skills in child and children and peer pressure. Peer pressure in any way has to be dealt with when it is, when you're talking about, the upbringing of a child. And I think that will help in not just about this point, but in general, as I said, in the general behavior of the child itself. There's another way in which you can ensure that this peer pressure and peer acceptance does not become so important in a child's life, but that's a larger point. I'll come to that in the end. As I said, the more general discussion which I'd like to speak about in the end, I'll mention about this again there. And as I said, you know, till the age of 15, 16, or till the age when the child leaves school, till then, I think it's fine for parents to decide which are the classes the child has to go and where the child has to spend more time. But by the age of 15 or 16, if the child is not developing interest in some particular art form, I think you can comfortably declare that the child doesn't seem to have interest in that, or maybe not worth pursuing, and, you know, maybe sometime later in life the child would come back and pick up that talent. But I think at the age of 16 or 17, if there is really that spark in the child, if there's really that interest, I think by then the child would have also developed some kind of affinity towards that talent. And because any talent will really shine forth if after a certain time the individual can himself or herself develop it and work on it. You know, you cannot have constantly the system of having tutors and trainers around you having the talent intact. At some time, the talent has to be owned by that person, or, you know, who's having the talent itself. So I think comfortably at the age of 16 or 17, by then the child should have certain interest, and, you know, there should be a willingness to go forward, move forward in that particular talent. If it is not there, probably I think you can quite comfortably declare that, you know, that's not something of interest for the child. And you could probably see what are the other things which really interest the child. And that's why, you know, parenting is not about, it's not like any other work which we do, which we, you know, take a decision and then let it run. It's about constantly observing and constantly looking at the child and seeing what are the interests. I think that is why it's also important to note that, especially if you're trying to send the child to some classes or something, this excuse of the people around me, my friends don't think it's very interesting, could even be an excuse. There could be some other problem, maybe in the classes, maybe in the process of learning itself, which the child is not comfortable with. And this excuse of peer pressure has been given as an alibi. You know, so you'll have to be very cautious of that too. If there is any other problem because of which the child does not want to pursue that particular field. So I think that is again something which you have to keep in mind. And I'm not mentioning specifically here about parents who force the children to go into some particular field, because you are specifically asking about honing skills after a spark has been recognized in your child. But I'll also make a few general observations. These are not about, I'm not saying that you might be doing this or you're doing this wrong. I'm just saying that these are general mistakes which parents can do. And if you're asking yourself this question that am I doing enough or am I pushing the child too much, maybe you can ask yourself, is my desire to help my child develop this talent coming from any of these points? And if it is not that, then I think you're safe. So I'll just mention a few points, maybe three or four points, to see whether your pushing of your child is motivated from any of these ideas and intentions, which are actually a very wrong way of trying to help the child develop a talent. Some parents put their children in every class possible. You know, you see this especially in the cities. The child goes for the martial arts, the music, the dance, and then the painting, and all the arts that you can think of, all the talents you can think of, the child is being forced to pursue all of that. So some parents have this tendency of putting the child in every class possible, and that is out of their own peer pressure. You know, you're talking about the peer pressure of the children, but parents also have their own peer pressure. When they look at their friends and their colleagues and they say that, oh, these people are putting their children in all these classes, so I should also put my child in all of these classes. So is your pushing your child coming from that idea? If that is the case, then I think you will have to be a little more conscious of that. And that should not be the reason why you're pushing your child to develop a particular talent. It should not be your peer pressure. So, you know, you end up saying that so-and-so is sending the child to all these classes, so I will also send. And actually this becomes the basis for most of the problems which we see in parenting today, that specifically about the comparison about, you know, we always see this, you know, so-and-so's child is doing so well, so-and-so's child is having this particular talent, and he can sing so well, she can dance so well, why are you not able to do that? So it is we pushing our peer pressure onto our children, that we are having a certain idea that these are all things that the children should achieve, and we are trying to push that onto our children. So be cautious, ask yourself, that are you doing this? And this idea of, you know, pushing our children in this manner comes from the basic flaw which Swami would often talk about. That when you look at your child as your possession, when you look at your child as this is my son or my daughter, and that is so-and-so's son or so-and-so's daughter, I think there's something which Swami would very, very often speak about. The whole idea of parenting a child should be based on the idea of trusteeship. That this child has been entrusted to you, and you use the opportunity and you use all that is in your power to enable this child to grow and to reach its potential, but you still maintain that detachment from the child. You maintain that this is a child which has been entrusted to me. One of the most beautiful chinakathas and explanations that Swami would give is that of a very, very diligent and very honest principal of a school. So Swami would say that this man has been a principal for something like 10 years or 20 years or whatever it is. He's taken very good care of a school. He's a very good administrator, takes good care of all the children and teachers in his care. And then Swami says that he has this cabin in the school, the principal's office. He sits there and, you know, functions from there. So one particular day the order comes that, you know, it's time for him to leave. He's reached the retirement age. So Swami would so beautifully and so descriptively speak of that. Swami would say that he will get up from his chair. You know, in those days they used to have this towel which they would put over their shoulder and, you know, an upper cloth. So Swami would say that he will take that cloth, just dust it, put it on his shoulder and walk away. So all the furniture, all the papers, the cupboards, the classrooms with all their furniture and the children and the teacher. So Swami says he does not take anything along with him. As long as he was the principal, as long as the school was under his charge, he discharges his duties perfectly. But when the time comes for him to go, Swami says he just takes his towel, which is his only possession, and he walks out. And Swami would often say that that is how we need to work in our workplace. That is how parents have to take care of their children. So when we start looking at our children as our possession, then we start comparing our possession with others' possessions. Just like how when I have a big house, I can't help but compare my house with my friend's house, or my car or my vehicle with my friend's car or vehicle. And the same thing as parents we tend to do with our children. So ask yourself, why are you making your child pursue? I'm not saying that you're doing this, but this is a checkpoint I think all parents should ask themselves. Is it by any chance motivated by these kind of thoughts? Then if it is, then I think you need to step back and review your commitment to putting your child through that process of developing their talent. And the other thing is, some parents, especially in cities, you see this, they tend to put their children in all kinds of classes, not because the children need it, but more because, you know, that's the best way to keep the child occupied. You know, you fill the day of the child with all these classes because you don't know what to do when the child is free. So if that is the case, again, see, all of these things are not coming from the right intention from the parent. So this will add to the burden of the child. So if even if the child is really not enjoying learning that particular art, you will be forcing the child into it because it's not that the child needs it, but you need the child to go to the class because you don't know what to do with the child's time. So that is another point. The second point I want to make is that are you sending your child because you want to be free, or you are not able to think of any better way to occupy the child's time? And the last thing which I wanted to mention is something else which we have to be careful as parents. Are we doing this to our children? Many times parents try to achieve what they could not achieve through their children. If they had an ambition, if they had a goal in life, probably they did not have the ability to reach that for various reasons. They did not have the opportunity, or they did not go to the classes like the children. So parents tend to try to achieve what they could not achieve through their children. Again, this is a problem. It's a fundamental problem in parenting itself. Like very beautifully Khalil Gibran says in one of his poems, he says that parents should constantly remember that the children come through them, but the children are not a part of them. Children, as I said, they're not like the possession or an extension of themselves. They are just being parents, and the children are coming to the world through them. So you can't give the children the opportunity that you did not have. Suppose you think that, I did not have the opportunity to go to these classes, so let me give that to my child. That's a different approach. But if you say that I could not achieve this, so I will make my child achieve it, I think there the intention gets a little blurred, and probably it's not the right approach. So much of, when you ask this question, how do we know that if we are pushing our child too much, how do we know that, are we doing enough for our child? There is no really one answer to that. There is no way you can clear cut say that this much you can do as a parent, this much alone that you need to do. It's very difficult to say that. But the moment you purify your intentions, moment you say that, with these intentions, I will look at the case in point. With these intentions, I will review this particular decision that I have made or I have to make. So then you will more or less, even if you make a mistake, then there is still that possibility that you might still be pushing your child a little more than you need to, or you might be giving lesser importance to all of these things. But the moment we purify our intentions, you can be sure that eventually what happens is going to be good. The child will eventually benefit from whatever we do. They might not develop that talent, maybe, but definitely that there is a certain learning that happens in every experience we go through. So there's something the child will bring up from that, but we can ensure that we are not doing these mistakes, that our intention of putting the child through that grind of that extracurricular activity, apart from what is already going on in school, is not because of these flaws, because these are flaws in us, which we tend to cover up with the idea that, I'm doing this for my child, or you might actually be slogging out and doing this. You can see that in many parents. They might be doing overtimes, they might be pushing themselves, earning more than they can probably earn, so that they can make their children get this better opportunity. That is not wrong, but if the intention is any of what I mentioned, these three or four points that I mentioned, if that is the intention, then you might end up harming the child rather than benefiting the child. So these are points that you have to keep in mind, but in general, what Swami would always say, as I said, I spoke about that beautiful example that Swami would give of a principle. For any parenting method to really work, I think you need a little bit of that detachment. And in fact, there's nothing like detachment specific for parenting or detachment specific for a mother or a father. Swami says, in general in life, that we need to develop this detachment. And it's not just about detachment, but it is about the combination of complete involvement and detachment. I think I've spoken about that a couple of times before. This is actually the basis of every activity that we do. The best way to perform any activity is with complete involvement and complete detachment when it comes to the results. So this is a general development of our spiritual nature, which will be very, very helpful even when it comes to aspects of our parenting. And in fact, it's both ways. If you have this nature, you will be a very, very good parent. But in the process of parenting too, you can develop this nature. I think that is the benefit of, you know, being in that role of a mother or a father, because that's probably the most onerous task that can be given to an individual. The welfare of another individual is entrusted to you. I mean, that's probably the greatest task that can be given to an individual. So there is a lot of progress that can be made spiritually just by playing that role of a mother or a father. But, you know, as I don't need to tell that to you, but it's a very, very precarious and very, very important role that you play. So these are some points which I spoke about and which I wanted to mention, that you can review your own intention to ensure that you're not pushing your child because of these reasons. Probably quickly, I'll just mention them again. It's not because of your own peer pressure. You don't want to, you compare yourself with other parents and their children and you don't want to be left out. It's not because of that peer pressure that you're pushing your child to go into all of these classes. Ensure that you don't do that. Don't look at your children as possessions and compare your possessions with others' possessions. You know, they are, at the end of the day, different individuals. And that is something that you have to always keep in mind. The third point that I said was, are you sending your child to all of these classes and trying to get the child involved in all of this because you are not able to manage the child, time of the child? You are not able to give time to the child. If any of these reasons are there, then maybe it's again something that you need to review again. You know, even when you go to a gym, and you are trying to build your body, there's something which the gym trainer will always tell you, that don't come to the gym 7 days of the week. Come 5 days of the week or 4 days of the week. Because he would say that, you know, these are the days which you train in the gym are very, very important, but the muscle does not grow when you're actually training. The muscle actually grows those 2 or 3 days when you take a break from coming to the gym. So those days when your time is free, that when you're not doing all the training, is as important as the days when you're doing the training. I think same is the case for anything else. When we're trying to develop our talent, there needs to be some free space. Let's not fill the children's time with all kinds of classes from morning to night. I mean, it is being done with good intention, but you know, you would just be tiring the child and not giving that opportunity for growth at all. So even if you're doing it for the child with the best benefit in your mind, keep in mind that a little bit of free space is the time when the child actually grows, just like how the muscle grows in the body. And the last point which I said was, you know, don't, as parents, ask yourself, are you trying to achieve through your child what you could not achieve? Give the child the opportunities that you wish you had. That is absolutely right. I think all parents do that. But don't try to achieve through the child what you could not achieve. Ask yourself if you're doing that. I think these are a few checkpoints that you'll have to keep in mind. Now, coming to the more fundamental point, that the whole of this thing, you said the background for this question that you're asking is a statement that Swami had. I'm sorry, you mentioned that the background to the whole thing is a particular statement that Swami had made. To repeat that, I think one of the students, when he was speaking in Swami's presence, made this point that talent is a gift of God and it has to be offered back to God. And when he made this statement, Swami stopped him and Swami said, talent is not a gift of God, talent is God. So what does Swami really mean by that? I think that's a very important statement, very profound statement. And if we try to understand what Swami meant by that, I think we will we will learn a new approach as to how you look at any form of talent itself. In the scriptures, there is this definition for this word which we often use for God. We often use this word Bhagwan, right? When Swami, we say Bhagwan Baba, Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. What is the meaning of this word Bhagwan, the Sanskrit word Bhagwan? It means Bhaga. The word Bhaga actually means opulence, form of many riches and, plentifulness, right? Opulence is the meaning of the word Bhaga. And Bhagavan means the one of the opulent one, if you could put it that way, or the one who is the owner of all these opulences. And it is said that when you say Bhaga, the opulence, there are six types of opulence they speak about in the scriptures. And it is mentioned that God is one who has all of these in perfect measure. So that's why he is God. And the things which they usually refer to is wealth, which is dhana, and creativity of all kinds. Actually, the aspects of creation, sustenance, and destruction. But it is also referred to as creativity, virya, that is one of the qualities, and any form of authority, any form of power, which we refer to in the Sanskrit word Aishwarya. And then vairagya, or detachment, and jnana, or knowledge, and yashas, or fame. So these six qualities, it is said that God has in perfect measure, and that is why he is referred to as Bhagwan. But the interesting thing is what the scriptures say, that all the wealth everywhere belongs to God. All the fame that you can ever acquire or anybody can ever acquire actually belongs to God. All the talent that can be ever seen, all the creativity that can ever be seen actually belongs to God. Well, that is the definition of God. It's not about an entity who has all of these qualities, who is perfect in all of these six spheres of life, but one who actually owns every form of fame that you can see, owns every form of wealth that you can see. That is the definition. And, you know, probably a way of looking at it is, let's say my father buys a home, right? You know, he has earned all his life, he has saved money, and he buys a home. So let's say he builds a 5-bedroom apartment or a 4-bedroom apartment. So after we get into the house, I say that this room is mine. Then my sister says that this room is mine. Then we say that this is a guest room. And somebody says that this is the parents' room, or this is my grandparents' room, or whatever it is. End of the day, the whole house actually belongs to my father. My father is the one who has earned it, and, you know, he's saved from his earnings and he's built the house. But within the house, we say that this is my room, this is your room, and then we say that this is my bed, and then we decorate it and say that, oh, I'm going to have my room furnished this way. But end of the day, the whole house actually belongs to this one person. Same is the case with all the wealth in the world. Now they say that you may have this wealth, and for momentarily you might hold it and say that this is my earnings, or this is my savings, or this is my wealth, this is my treasure. But that is a very momentary trusteeship that you have. But everything actually belongs to God. In the same way as I explained, that the father of the house actually owns every room in the house. But when you go into the house, they will say that this room belongs to me, and that room belongs to my sister or my brother or anything like that. So this is something that is a description of God. And now if you look at the talent part of it, the creativity part of it, or the knowledge part of it, probably a better way of looking at it is, it's like puddles of water reflecting the resplendent moon. There are these many puddles, small puddles, and dirty water and clear water, or whatever it is. All of these reflect the effulgence of the moon, but actually the effulgence belongs to the moon and the moon alone. In the same way, I think many of us have some talents in us, which is nothing but a reflection of all the talent which actually belongs to God. Right? That is how they speak of it. So everything that we speak of as something of importance to us, and if you look at these six qualities which are named, which is wealth, creativity, authority, detachment, knowledge, and fame, they speak of it as qualities which can actually attract others. When you look at it, people get attracted to these qualities. When you're rich, somebody, you know, you catch people's attention when you're rich. When you're creative, you catch people's attention. When you have power, you catch people's attention. When you have detachment also, you catch people's attention. People actually wonder, you're doing something which they cannot do. So you catch people's attention and you draw people's notice to yourself. And Swami says even fame, because fame begets fame. You become famous. For instance, let's say that so-and-so is a good singer or a good speaker. So the fame spreads that so-and-so is a good speaker. Then there would be at least 70-80% of the people who say that he's a very good speaker who actually would have never heard him speak or would have never heard him sing or, experienced it firsthand. Just that fame begets more fame. So in that sense, all of these six qualities actually can lead to more fame or lead to people taking notice of you, right? So when we say that Bhagwan is one who is the repository of all of these six qualities, which we temporarily possess, which we are trustees of temporarily, be it wealth, be it knowledge, be it fame, be it even the idea of detachment, all of this we possess for a limited period. The beauty of all of these qualities is, all of these can actually lead to ego. When we think that we own these things, when we think that these are mine, it will lead to ego. But when you come to this idea, when you start, that is why they say that when you become a devotee, when you look at the principle which we call divinity and say Bhagwan, we are actually saying that God, all that I possess, all that I am, all that I know, everything belongs to you, and I'm just like that, the puddle or a pool which is reflecting your brilliance. It doesn't belong to me. When you come to that idea of trusteeship, you don't allow any of these qualities to add ego to you. You actually reflect you, any fame that comes to you, any accolade that comes to you, you direct it towards God, saying that, it belongs there. I mean, I'm just being somebody who is reflecting it, right? So this is an important thing that we have to keep in mind. Every quality that is in us, which can catch somebody else's attention, is being given to us for a temporary period, and we are actually like trustees. We are holding it for a limited time. And when people praise us for that, we need to ensure that we direct all of that praise and accolade to God where it really belongs. So this again speaks about, these are all qualities of God. But I started off by saying that talent is a gift of God, right? How is it that talent is God? These are all show that talent is a gift of God, because that's what it is. When we say that wealth is given to you for some time, fame is given to you for some time, knowledge is given to you for some time, it is about talent being a gift, right? That pertains to that statement. What do we mean by saying that talent is God? If you look at the Vedas, there is this very beautiful description of how the creation came to be, right? They say that God was absolute. God was having no qualities. He was attributeless. So when God wants to create the world, the first thing he creates is Akasha, right? That's what the Vedas say, that from the absolute comes Akasha. And when we say Akasha, it's not the sky element. It's not the sky that we see here. And that is the gross Akasha or the gross sky. But what he creates is called a Tanmatra. It's a subtle form of the element. In other words, the beautiful description the Vedas give is, God created a means by which he could be known. He created a quality through which he can be accessed. So here is this attributeless absolute, which says that now I am creating the ability to know me through sound. That is the essence of him creating Akasha. And then he says, I now take on myself the attribute of being seen. Now I take on the attribute of being heard. So each one of these is an attribute. I mean, if I can explain that in a different way. I'm sitting in the studio and speaking to all of you. And Swami is omnipresent. Swami is everywhere. So Swami is in the studio right now, right? But let's say that suddenly I get this fragrance of Swami. I get this waft of Swami's perfume. So what will I tell when I experience this? I will say, I can feel Swami's presence. I will say, Swami is here. But what is actually happening is, Swami is permitting his presence to be known through the attribute of that fragrance, right? Or I'm sitting here and let's say I suddenly hear Swami's voice. So Swami is allowing me to access His presence through the attribute of sound, right? So all of these qualities that we say that these are all qualities of God, when we say that these six attributes are attributes of Bhagavan, what we mean is these are not just qualities of God, but these are also access points through which you can access God. In that sense, these actually become inseparable from God. When I say that I can feel Swami's presence, I don't say that, you know, today in studio, I felt the presence of Swami's fragrance. I won't say that. I'll say today I felt Swami's presence. Or if I hear Swami's voice, I'll say I heard Swami. I will not say I heard a voice which was like Swami. Because that which allows you access to divinity is actually one with divinity. Dharma is a means to God. Dharma is God. Satya or truth is a means to God. Truth is God. Love is a means to God. Love is God. Similarly, talent is a means to God. Talent is a gift of God. But at the same time, talent is God, because talent is an expression of that divinity itself. Right? So this is how actually it is what we mean by saying that talent is God. But in fact, if you look at it, what is it that catches attention of people around us? Whatever you do, let's say that, you know, in whatever profession that you do, let's say that you're a carpenter. But if you're able to do your work with such perfection and such excellence, the people around you will notice you. Right? They will take notice of you and you will be standing apart. I'm sorry. So you'll be standing apart and that excellence will show out in the people around you, right? So that excellence is actually a sign of God. That excellence is a means by which you actually move towards God. And that is why there's a beautiful statement in the Vedas which says, Yogaha Karmasu Kaushalam. Right? Yogaha means union with God. Karmasu Kaushalam is perfection in action. So that is why it is said that any action that you do, it need not be music, it need not be painting or sculpture or any such form of talent, but anything that you do, the more you start becoming perfect in that, the more you start striving for excellence in that, that itself starts opening a pathway to access God. And that's why any of these talents, especially when we talk about talents such as music, dance, and we refer to them as fine arts. I think it's music, dance, sculpture, painting, and poetry, right? Poetry and literature, right? These five are referred to as fine arts because these are ways which are literally eternal. Ever since man could express, man wanted to express the ecstasy of knowing God or loving God or his experiences, these are the five means that he has used. So these are five qualities or five talents literally for which we use to express ourselves and which are means to understand and access God. So that is why these are important. The problem is, you know, I spoke about the six qualities of dana or of authority, of fame, of knowledge, of creativity and all of that. In today's world, I think we are literally shutting out the joy of the other forms, which are the other attributes of God. We are only able to understand and enjoy our life through wealth and through fame and authority. So literally, we try to encash everything into only money, authority or fame. But there are some things which inherently actually have that beauty of joy, right? Suppose you're learning music. Suppose you become a very good singer. You start excelling in the art of singing. Automatically, you know, in modern day, we say that I have this talent. So let me go and showcase this talent. Let me collect fame in the process. And when I become famous, I can encash that fame into money. And when I have money, I will have power and authority. So we are converting every form of joy and every form of access to God that we have into either, you know, power, money or fame. But the fact is, these talents, especially when you talk about music, of poetry, of painting, there is a joy inherent in them. And I think as parents, especially when we are trying to encourage our children to take any of these talents. It's very important to teach our children to find the joy in it as it is, rather than trying to teach them any particular talent, for that matter, even any form of sport. We should resist the temptation of allowing our children to develop these talents with the idea that going forward, I can make money out of this, I can become famous out of it. I think becoming famous and expressing our talent and showcasing our talent and making a name for ourselves should be secondary. When we especially encourage such talents in our children, can we put this idea in the child that, you know, this is a form by which you can express yourself. This is a form by which you can access that divinity within you. Don't worry about you singing for somebody else, you know, you making money out of your poetry that you write, or, you know, you becoming an artist and you selling your paintings in an exhibition or something like that. Just learn the art for the joy of the art itself. Learn music for the joy of the music itself. In fact, that is why if you see many, many even scientists, they would always have this passion for one instrument or the other. They would say that Albert Einstein used to play the violin. I mean, closer home, Professor Venkatraman actually enjoys playing the flute. And many scientists, there's another great scientist who used to play the veena. And for that matter, even some other people, like you would find some bankers who love playing a saxophone, or you would find a cricketer who likes playing the guitar. These are talents. There should be some talents that we pursue in life, not for the sake of encashing into fame and money, but for the joy of that talent itself. So can we teach our children this? Because we live in a world where everything that we do, we seek to immediately share it and earn a name and fame for that. I write a poem, I want to post it on Facebook. I take a beautiful picture, I immediately want to post it on Instagram and see how many people like it and share it or whatever it is. Because we have come to a point where all the joy that we seek is through the validation that we achieve, that we gain from others. I do something and the people around me should appreciate it, and I will derive joy from that appreciation. But there is a certain amount of joy that can be drawn from the talent itself. That's why Swami would say that when you read a good book, when you listen to good music, it's not about you going around telling people, I heard this music and I'm a fan of this music, or then you start singing and you upload that into YouTube, whatever it is. It is that moment of enjoying that talent as an access to God. And that is why these are all important. Swami would give so much importance to the bhajan singers in a college, or for that matter, the instrumentalists, the speakers, the people who used to recite poetry in Swami's presence. It's because these are all talents by which a person who listens to them, a person who sees them, can access God. So I think it's important to teach our children the value of these talents as they are, not because, you know, in future you can become a great singer, in future you can achieve this. I think that is where the problem of the peer pressure itself starts. Because we are constantly teaching our children that they have to do things which catch the attention of others, rather than do things perfectly, do things for their sake. Learn music for the sake of music. Do a painting just for the joy of doing a painting. Do some sculpture, but just for the joy of enjoying that talent and making an offering to God. Because each one of these is an access point, is a means that we have to reach out to God. But if we only start encashing all of that, then, you know, when we as parents ask our children to pursue a particular form of talent with that attitude, then there is no difference between that talent and probably the child going to school and getting a degree and, you know, becoming a doctor or an engineer or whatever it is. See, I think at least in Indian families, we always give the children a safety net. We ensure that they go to the university. But when we teach them talent, can we ensure that the child develops the talent and put that idea in the child that, you know, you may not become a singer, you may not become a dancer, it doesn't really matter. Learn this, because this is going to be a way by which you can reach within to your own self through these art forms. Learn these art forms for that, just for the sake of joy of it. And can we put that idea into our children? I think if we do that, it really doesn't matter whether the child becomes a professional singer or the child becomes a professional artist. But you would have given a means of reaching out within for each child. I think that is more important than really seeing if that talent blooms to the, you know, whatever is what we think is the culmination of that talent. I think that's very, very important. The moment we put this, I think the idea of peer pressure itself will start withering away, because everything the child does, it looks for approval of people around it, of its friends, of its classmates. But this idea that there can be some things that you do purely for the joy of it, and it's absolutely all right. You don't have to make money out of it. But Swami says that if it happens that the child enjoys that so much, it wants to make that particular talent its profession, I think that's a different thing, that you can take that call as time goes. But at least when we are training our children, we can teach our children to enjoy these things for the sake of them. And that is why talent is God, because every talent is an access point to God. You can either turn inward and access God, or you can turn outward and make money and name and fame. I think that choice is always there. But I think as a parent, you are in a very beautiful and very, very significant position to teach your children to use talent to reach out inside. I think this is what I wanted to say. I don't know if I was clear enough. As I said, you know, as parents, just to quickly summarize the first point, part of the answer, I said that as parents, that you have the right to take decisions for your child at least till the age of 15 or 16, that you are in a better position to decide for the child than the child himself or herself. So there's nothing wrong in that. You can do that. But I said that ensure that your intention of putting the child through a training process is in the right place, by ensuring that you're not doing that because you want to compare your child with other children, or you want to achieve something that you could not achieve through your child. Ensure that it's none of these. And then finally, I said, teach children to pursue these arts, especially these fine arts, for the sake of the joy of the fine arts themselves. And Swami would very, very beautifully say that, you know, all of these arts are meant to be offered back to God. In the process, if you make money, in the process, if you make name and fame, have nothing to do with it. It comes and goes. It will not affect you. But your primary benefit that you draw out of that art or that talent must be the joy of doing that. And in a way, if you bring God into that, when you say that I'm doing this for God, I'm offering this to God, when music becomes a form of prayer, then there is a greater opportunity there to use these as access points to reach out to God and reach out to the God within. And I hope I've answered that question. If you have anything more to ask, any clarifications on the basis of what I've said, feel free to write to me and I'll be happy to answer that. So with that, dear listeners, it's time to wrap up this week's program. Do you have a question on any practical decisions that you have to make, or many practical problems, and you're wondering what would be a spiritual solution for that, or what would be more clearly Swami's solution for that? You can send it to me. My mail ID is prem@radiosai.org. I would be glad to answer your question on the show based on what Swami has told on various occasions. It would be wonderful if you can record your own question and send it to me. That way I can play out your question and then answer it. Thanks, Sister Kavita, for that question, a very beautiful question. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. I'm going to leave you all with a beautiful Marathi song. As I said, this is Devi Navratri, and it's befitting to conclude the program with a beautiful song on Mother. On the other side of the song, you'll be joined by Raghu. At 12:30, I'll be back here with Arvind for the next episode of Afternoon Satsang. But join me again 11 a.m. next week for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth.
Maya Bhavani, tujhe le karu kushi ta tujhe aaye. मानुन के आई सेवा मानुन के आई म manunage aayi seva manunage aayi tu vishwaati rachili maya tu sheetal chhaaye chikaaya tu vishwaati rachili maya tu sheetal chhaaye chikaaya tujha daye ta ho gha khandit duritalaya manunage aayi